the National Archives podcast series, cataloguing projects during 2016. Discoveries found in our catalogue Discovery, presented by Dr. Nat Alcock and Christine Hodgetts.
Our next speaker is Dr. Nat Alcock. Nat has been to many catalogue days as a delegate, and it's my pleasure to introduce him as a speaker today on discoveries in discovery and outside, apparently. Thank you.
Yes, a bit of it is outside, and a lot of it is context. I'm afraid the title gives you absolutely no clue as to what I'm going to talk about, but that's not unreasonable, because when I was invited and thought of a title, I didn't have a clue what I was going to talk about either. And I felt a little bit diffident about this, so I asked my good friend Christine Hodgetts to contribute from her experience. So this is a joint venture, but she has delegated me to talk about it. She is here, just sitting there, so any questions that arise from her material, she will deal with. Warning that this isn't going to be a systematic or in-depth overview. Both of our types of research we do tend to be small, self-contained chunks, each calling for scan through discovery and all the other sources that we might want to call on to see what comes to light. And a little bit more of a health warning, we're both based in Warwickshire, so our research is mostly, though not entirely, focused there. Well, one disappointment in Warwickshire is that none of the Warwickshire Poor Law Unions were part of the MH12, which has the detailed listing of correspondence with the Poor Law Commissioners, which produce fascinating things. We'd love to see more of that appear. Hope for the best there. Well, the first example is a real case of serendipity. There's a lot of serendipity in this talk. It concerns a commission to research buildings and families in the village of Clifford Chambers for a local history publication. This was the publication that ensued from this. Well, Clifford Chambers is a reasonably respectable term, and a fairly standard search for chancery references produced a modest number of cases in which the village is mentioned, some of which were relevant. But unexpectedly, references to a series that I'd never encountered before, though it is described briefly in Lists and Indexes 10, published in 1899. The principal series, C91, the Prefixed Reference, produced a set of depositions in a case between the Lord of the Manor of Clifford Chambers, about to whom the church house belonged. But the depositions give a fascinating picture of a building that stood at the corner of the churchyard in Clifford Chambers. It was used as a meeting house with a schoolhouse over it, where the parishioners met in Whitsun Week. And it had been rebuilt by the parish sometime about 1620. One of the oldest inhabitants said she remembered it having been rebuilt. And they include evidence from the schoolmaster, who was there in 1656. Now, the school survived. It's shown on this plan of 1880, and it's not shown on this photograph of 1900. I think actually the photograph would just clip where it had been. But in fact, in 1896, it was replaced as the school. It was highly unsatisfactory. There were something like 70 pupils, and the schoolroom only had room for 35 desks, so it's well past its sell-by date. But I'm rather disappointed that they didn't leave it there. They wanted to turn it into a reading room, and then they decided against that and simply pulled it down, so it's now a blank. Well, Chris and my next forays were rather more substantial into the fascinating area of Chancery Master's exhibits. But this and some of the related searches highlight a specific problem. We both wanted to find either the Earl of Warwick or the town of Warwick. And we can search for Warwick. But in many places, the catalogue uses, for example, Charlecote, County Warwick, rather than Warwickshire. And of course, we've also got people other than the Earl of Warwick to be weeded out. I had a rather more serious and curious problem when I tried to recreate my search. I wanted to relocate records in C113, and the first of these catalogue entries, which I've doctored up a bit, mentions Lord Brooke with or without an E, but doesn't actually say anything about Warwick. But fortunately, there is a cross-reference to the Historical Monuments Commission Principal Families volume, and so we're able to look that up. Though, curiously enough, when I come to the entry that is much clearer, which is the second one of these, and look at C113-208, again, which I didn't recognise, but when we find the details of that, it says missing. So I don't know about that. Perhaps the strays and fragments would care to rediscover it. I've not managed to discover the case to which these relate. Chris may know a bit more about this than I do, but even with these titles, but what the exhibits produce is particularly valuable for building research, notably for some work that I did in Ulster, since the exhibits include a rent account volume for the Earl's estates, which covers 1727-34 and fills a vital gap in the series of these rent accounts that exist in the Warwick Castle archives in the Warwickshire County Record Office. So this was a very valuable and useful discovery. Chris's research into Chancery's Master's exhibits and the Chancery records that spin out from them, or vice versa, has been much more detailed. This exhibit relates to a complaint of misappropriation of funds by Warwick Corporation. And the particular significance of the exhibit is that it includes detailed accounts for the corporation and depositions in relating to the building of the courthouse in the 1720s. What is particularly significant here is that the existence of the case was known. It had been referred to in other documents, but searches, for example, by the noted architectural historian Howard Colvin had actually failed to find it. So Chris has done better than that highly esteemed historian. Here, the primary evidence is easy to find in the form of four items in C11, of which the most significant is the last of these, containing interrogatories and depositions. However, Chris has pursued the case with great vigour, as well as the bills and depositions and exhibits. She's gone into the orders in C33, the master's reports in C38, putting together not only the building details for the courthouse, but also other useful material. And here are the receiver's accounts presented to the master. Here are the lists of references to the actual bills and so on in C11 and the depositions there. Here, Chancellor Master's reports. I don't think you find these by searching for Warwick, but you can do once you know what you're looking for. Now, my next discovery relates to a notable Essex house called Tiptofts in Wimbish Parish, which has a very fine hammer-beam-roofed open hall. And it was previously thought to date to about 1325 and therefore to have been built by somebody called Sir John de Wharton at about that date. However, colleagues of mine looked again for me at the dating evidence and decided that actually it was a considerably earlier, significantly earlier than that had been thought. And the best evidence for the dates puts the building of the hall range of this house at 1280 to 1303, the wing at 1287 to 1299, probably, though not demonstrably, contemporary at about 1295 to 1300. And this means that the builder isn't the Sir John de Wharton about whom a certain amount is known from local sources, but somebody called Bartholomew de Enfield, a name which is extremely troublesome. A few variations that you can have there. And searching through for him, a number of interesting things came to light, specifically in the Duchy of Lancaster records. Bartholomew de Enfield, with some of his references here, proves to be a really very interesting character. The name, extremely variable, and I'm really not sure that I've found all the references that apply to him, but here are some primarily from DL25, Deeds of the Duchy of Lancaster. And it's clear from these that Bartholomew is a major member of the entourage of Humphrey de Bohun, Earl of Hereford and Essex. Both indeed the father and the son, both called Humphrey. The father died in 1298. And Bartholomew went to Gascony with Bohun in 1294, was indentured as a retainer in 1307, and indeed in 1321 he granted his lands in Wimbish, which in fact was this hall, Tiptofts, to Humphrey de Bohun, and they both appointed attorneys to transfer seizing. They neither of them turned up there, and there are the two letters of attorney with the various seals there. These are the seals of Humphrey de Bohun. There is a seal of Bartholomew, but at that stage I hadn't in fact seen it. I looked at it this morning, and it's a very handsome affair indeed, but detached from something still to be located. Now, the importance of all this is that it shows Bartholomew moving in high circles in the Bohun affinity. And we can now see, which would otherwise remain very mysterious, how he would have been able to encounter the innovative carpenters who were just developing at this date the hammer beam truss. This is either the very earliest surviving hammer beam roof hall, or the second or third so, but it's a very early example indeed. Surprisingly, I also found a whole other family of Enfields there, which are Henry and John, also part of the Bohun affinity, but I have yet to work out whether they are connected to Bartholomew, or whether they just both came from Enfield, or have some other reason for their name. Enfield did belong to Humphrey de Bohun, so it's entirely possible that bright young lads from his manor could have been swept up to join his affinity. Well, our next successful explorations have been in another very interesting resource, the Admiralty Correspondence in ADM 106. The first excursion here starts from a landscape survey that Chris undertook relating to Clanes in Worcestershire, where a 1751 map reveals an intriguing area, the Whitening Yard, together with a mill and mill pond, all leased to somebody whose tenant's name is given in the documents here, John Garway. But when you come to find out who on earth is this, what's all this about, we search for Garway in Discovery and get a fair number of hits, of which these, a block in ADM 106, show what is going on. He was, in fact, a sailmaker and regular supplier to the Admiralty, although it also shows up that in 1750 or thereabouts, he came to grief and was made bankrupt. So some of the other records that we have show his property, which he had acquired, being sold off by his bankruptcy trustees. The second area we looked at in ADM 106 is really the beginning of an investigation, and I don't know where it's going to go. Maybe in a few years' time you can ask me back and I will tell you. But at the moment, it's into the use of Welsh timber by the Admiralty. Now, this isn't a very easy search at all. Wales finds the principality, it finds the ship, the Prince of Wales, and also, tediously, whale. Discovery likes you to use either whale or Wales. It tends to ignore the final S there. So gunwales, anyway, without the gun bit on them, also appear quite regularly. But there are, out of some 100 or so or 200 references, a number which do relate to Welsh timber and have some interesting indications, particularly that mainly Welsh timber began to be used in the middle of the 18th century, although there are very few references earlier than that. It seems to have come into use about then, and that's perhaps something that would be interesting to explore further. However, browsing through these references produced one most unexpected letter, and this is another piece of serendipity. In fact, I'm not even sure how, from the searches that I did, I actually found it. But there, among the records that I downloaded into a data file, was this bottom one here. the composition for seasoning ship's timbers given by Benjamin Slade to a correspondent. He was the purveyor at the Woolwich Yard, clearly much involved, rather high level, and he explained how you use this with saltpeter, common salt, and alum. And for somebody who's interested in the use of a timber, this was something I was not aware of at all and is a very intriguing piece of information. The final search that I've done in ADM 106 was for references to one Robert Crown, an interesting character, as I think we will see in a moment, but where I have to declare a personal rather than an academic or historical interest. He is my four times great-uncle, or four or five times great-uncle. Crown is even worse than Wales. You've got ships called the Crown. You've got the Crown itself. You've got the Crown Inn, the Crown Coffee House, Danzig Crown planks, Danzig Crown masts, or Polish Crown mask, Crown glass, Crown pitch, Crown paper. Fortunately, the only references of the several hundred that Crown produces that seem to relate to Robert Crown do actually spell him out as Robert Crown. So we can find these, and a really nice pair of letters from Captain Burnaby saying, may I have Mr. Robert Crown as my new master because my present one has been re-employed, and that he has exceedingly good character. Well, once you have the ship's name, it's straightforward to identify somebody like Robert Crown in pay books, muster rolls, and especially his own master's logs. As we see, for example, on the Cormorant, 1779 to 80, his log, his signature there on the front page, they were sailing off Cape Finisterre at this point. But there's pages and pages and pages of this. So his naval career is opened up for exploration. But the significance of him, apart from being my great-great-great-uncle, is in his later career, because he was appointed acting second lieutenant in Diana, but when the ships paid off, the Admiralty refused to ratify this. What happened precisely next, I don't know. But in 1788, he was appointed a lieutenant in the Russian Navy. Catherine the Great was collecting officers to serve in her navy, and he did extremely well. He was later captain, rear admiral, finally admiral, and involved in a number of notable actions, including the one represented perhaps rather fancifully here in this picture. And there is, firstly, a picture of him, a lithograph from Russian sources, and secondly, again, a search, not on Discovery, but on Google, shows that the National Maritime Museum has a miniature of him. So I really found quite a lot more out about him. The final explorations that I've got to report relate to using Discovery for documents not at TNA. Not long ago, I found that the Holford Bowls Club in Warwickshire had, was founded in 1785 and still going strong, at least it was until last year. And it retained its archives at Warwickshire Record Office from 1786. And there's the green there and the first page of the minute book of the Bowls Club with the subscribers named listed there. Now, I wondered how unusual this was as an early survival. This particular club wasn't known to the author of this recent book on bowling called Bowled Over by Hugh Hornby, published last year. And here, searching for bowls, bowl, I think, or bowling, found a number of references, and in particular, two very early ones, and a number showing bowling clubs with records surviving from about the 1770s and 1780s. Intriguingly, the two early references, Rugeley and in Staffordshire and St. Blasey in Cornwall, are totally different types of documents. The Rugeley rules are rules for playing bowls, and they tell you about all the things you must do, and not to blaspheme on the bowling green, and so on. Whereas the St. Blasey is very like the Holford Bowling Club, are rules to manage a club of people who are going to meet and dine, and just like the Holford Club, play a bit of friendly bowls. Well, When I went back a few days ago just to recheck this, I found an item that I totally missed the time before. And this is the one we see down here in Nottinghamshire Archives, but again, coming up in that section of discovery on Search Other Archives, an invitation of 1785 to the meeting of the subscribing gentlemen to the Bowling Green. And thanks to some rapid work by Nottinghamshire Archives, you can share this with me, seeing it for the first time. This, in the Edge of Strelley Archives, was almost certainly sent to Thomas Webb Edge of Sherborne, just south of Warwick, and he was indeed a member of the club for its first couple of years. Now, my other illustration from the TNA for non-TNA records, but from Discovery, highlights a known problem with Discovery, not in this case one where TNA is responsible, but here we are, the very important Warwickshire Record Office collection, the Newdigate of Arbury Hall Archive. It's one of the collections that was incorporated into A2A and therefore now is in Discovery. But if we look at this and do a search in the C series there, I've doctored this search so that it finds what I want to show you rather than the several hundred records that it does, we get in this specific example what I see as a particularly unsatisfactory form of cataloguing, box-level cataloguing, where you get a series of references, a list of places, and a list of dates. It was a favourite way of cataloguing, I think, in the 1950s, thankfully more or less abandoned now, but is extremely unhelpful for actually looking at things, because you've really got to go through in that box and see what it's got in it. Well, in a cataloguing project, not here, but at Warwick, we have, in fact, recatalogued to a considerable extent, but not in great detail, the Newdigate of Arbury catalogue. So there's now a very much better catalogue with a structure imposed on it. And if we go on from there, we can look at the record for one of those, which in fact it turns out that C208 in the previous list is actually part of a little group of records, all of which relate to the conveyance of the manor and lordship of Astley to probably a trustee in this case. And we're partly able to do this because an early 20th century catalogue written by the noted antiquarian J. Harvey Bloom gave much more detail that was ever included in the summary A2A catalogue. And, for example, this shows up something that is not listed at all under Discovery, a 1472 notary deed for Calais, which is an interesting document to find in itself. Well, nothing, no complaints here about TNA, except that they have for a long time promised that they're going to start incorporating new catalogues and, we hope, getting rid of outdated catalogues. So please, may this happen sooner rather than later. Finally, I couldn't resist putting in a little wish list of things that I would really like to see. Nothing to do with the First World War, I'm afraid, but some much earlier things that might or might not be readily done. There are the volumes of Cartae Miscellaneae, which are deeds whose seals were removed by John Cayley in the early 19th century, and he then bound them up in volumes. And these have some sort of finding aids, but if you want to look at them, you've got to consult these finding aids on the shelves in the map room. Then, moving down the list, the valuation map finder, I suppose that counts as part of Discovery, but it's a brilliant resource, but it has gaps, like the maps for London, which are at a larger scale than the 1 to 2500 maps that are used, so you cannot get information on those maps from the map finder. Now, another resource which I never remember to think about are the enormous number of images put on the website of the Anglo-American legal tradition from many, many TNA classes. But you cannot find, if you get starting from Discovery, you cannot find that a particular class has been photographed by the Anglo-American legal tradition. You can do it a bit the other way around, but please couldn't some more references be put on so that people are alerted to the existence of these. A slightly similar thing, early accounts enrolled in E364. There's a 1900 list and index volume but there's nothing in discovery. And the final two, access to resources for enrolled deeds. The enrolled deeds in the Common Pleas, CP43, not enormous in number, and there's a quite good IND catalogue for these, which would seem to be a relatively straightforward thing to capture. And then something that is perhaps not at all straightforward to catalogue, the enormous number of enrolled deeds on the close roll Dorsey's in C54. There are volumes and volumes of alphabets and grantors and grantees, but they're very hard to use, and it would be wonderful if one could access these a few places, but even the names of the people concerned would be extremely useful. They are very name-rich sources all the way through from Henry VIII, they go back earlier, but the earlier volumes are catalogued in calendars and so on, right through to the 19th century. Thank you.
This talk was recorded on the 25th of November, 2016, at the National Archives, Kew.
This podcast is copyright to the National Archives, all rights reserved. It is available for reuse under the terms of the Open Government Licence.